This is an Equity Beats Media podcast.
Everything you're about to hear is for education and entertainment purposes only. Whilst we are licensed, we're not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any advice is general advice. Equity Mates operates under Australian Financial Services Licence 540697.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is useful.
Welcome to Equity Mates Investing, a podcast where we explore what's possible in the world of investing. If you've just joined us for the first time, a huge welcome. My name is Bryce, and today we're talking all things property. We're revisiting the concept of rent vesting. We're looking at what equity recycling is, and then we've got a general market update from an expert property investor. To chat through it, as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How are you?
I'm very good, Bryce. I'm very excited for this episode. We don't often dip our toe in the property water.
No.
But we do love keeping our finger on the pulse.
Well, particularly now that we're in property.
Yeah. I think we've always been interested in knowing what's going on. It just takes a different bent once you're in
it. It's a different lens.
But we've had this expert on the show a couple of times before. He's fast becoming our correspondent from the world of the property investor. It is Sam Gordon. He's the director of Australian Property Scout, which is an investment buyers agency service helping people source quality in. Which is an investment buyer's agency service helping people source quality investment properties right across Australia. He also co-hosts the Scouting Australia podcast, and he's been a great resource to keep us updated with what's going on the other side of the fence.
Yeah, I always learn a lot from Sam. He always gets us quite enthused about the opportunities that exist in finding cash deals or growth deals in regional areas of Australia.
So, look, I
think there's opportunity. If you're sitting there thinking this episode's not for me because, you know, property's too expensive, the concepts that we cover today really do highlight how there are strategies available to get into property without needing huge deposits to get into capital cities.
Yeah. I wish I knew about the concept of rent vesting when I first started my first full-time job. It would have definitely changed the way I thought about investing generally.
Yeah. Well, we'll cover that all with Sam, as we will also be covering property at our live event here in Sydney in 5 days' time. Tickets are selling fast, so we're in the final few days. We're going live with the Ask an Advisor concept, and we're bringing in Glenn Hare from Fox & Hare, one of Australia's leading financial advisors, to give you the chance to ask him any money or investing question that you want, be it budgeting, property, investing, superannuation, you name it, you can ask it. So don't miss this opportunity to get access to leading financial advisors. Tickets are on sale. We're going in 5 days' time.
Can't wait. It's going to be so good. If you want to secure your ticket, head to equitymates.com/events. The link will also be in the show notes. With that said, a final thank you to Australian Property Scout for making this episode possible. Let's get to it.
Let's go. Sam, welcome to Equity Mates.
Boys, good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. So, we've got a lot of new audience with us in 2024. So before we kick off, can you just introduce yourself and give us a bit of background on your journey in property so far?
Yeah, for sure. So I started my journey, it's going on 15 years ago now. So I bought my first property at 19. Pretty much was a labourer, just kind of trying to work and find my way in the world and what I wanted to do. And I knew property was going to be my thing. I read very, very early on about Harry Triguboff, who at the time had about 3,000 apartments. I think he's got about 6,000 now. He's obviously the CEO, director of Meriton. And his story really, really inspired me to try and want to do something big with property. After buying that that first property at 19, I got bitten by the bug through renovations and renovated that property. And it was a chance encounter at the dentist of reading a property investment mag. And I literally read this thing for about 10 minutes, asked the dentist if I could take it home with me. And the rest is history. I read up and consumed as much content as I could. Back then, magazines were the big thing. Podcasts weren't around really back then. So magazines were was the big thing. Consumed as much content as I could, and really just built my portfolio, you know, in the ensuing years off the back of that. So I won Investor of the Year in 2020. I think I had about 30 odd properties at the time. Fast forward today, 54 property portfolio with 70 plus rentals off the back of that as well. And yeah, man, actually just won Buyer's Agent of the Year as well.
Oh, so nice. Yeah, man, congratulations.
There you go. There we go. So yeah, man, just like that's the journey. You know, I just absolutely love property, live, breathe it every single day, day in, day out. So yeah, I'm a massive property fanatic, and now I get to help people build their own portfolios as a day job. So oh, love it. It's cool.
Mm. Nice.
So yeah, you founded Australian Property Scout. That's where you won Buyer's Agent of the Year. Big congratulations there.
Thank you, mate.
And we've had you on the podcast a couple of times, and you've I guess opened our eyes to rent vesting. I still remember the first after the first episode, we were very excited about the concept.
And then we went.
Neither of us did it. Yeah,
and then you went and bought it. I remember when I came in for the second one, you guys told me. I was like, what?
Yeah. But we thought it would be a good chance to revisit rent vesting.
Okay.
And then we also get heaps of questions about equity recycling.
Cool.
So we want to ask our resident property expert what the go is there. And then finally, we want to talk about just what's happening in property in 2024, where the market is going, interest rates, all the good stuff that people love.
Perfect, man. Let's do it.
Let's start with rent vesting.
Yes.
And for people who are new to the concept, what is it?
So rent vesting in a nutshell is renting where you want to live, or renting instead of owning, and then using the additional serviceability that you have from renting instead of owning to then go and invest. So essentially you're renting at the same time that you're investing. And so often, if people make the decision to buy where they want to live, it's a very, very expensive thing, right? Because obviously where you want to live is typically somewhere quite nice, and the cost to live there is very expensive. When you conversely look at how much rents are in the area compared to that, like compared to that mortgage cost, it's typically a significantly smaller amount. The caveat on this is if you're in an area that might be in the sub $1 million bracket, because a lot of locations in Australia, if you're talking $600,000-$900,000, something like that, your rent's quite similar as a dollar value, maybe $600,000-$900 a week. The ratio doesn't really work so much on that end. It still works, but the serviceability isn't huge. But when you start talking about like a $1.5-$2 million plus sort of market, the rental rates in those areas are so small compared to what the mortgage cost is per week, per month, that there's a huge imbalance. And like for most capital cities now, that's kind of like a nice place to live in most capital cities around that price point. So that additional leftover, essentially borrowing capacity or serviceability leftover from renting in those areas as opposed to buying there, leaves a lot of additional borrowing to then be able to go out and build a portfolio.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, in Sydney, your mortgage repayments might be $1,000 a week and you might be renting for $500-$600 a week,
yeah,
and you can use that difference to then invest somewhere else. You were saying earlier you actually ran the numbers to give us a worked example.
I did, man. I did it this morning because we were kind of, when we talked about it last time, I never really brought the equation in. We were just talking about the you know, I guess the idea of it. I ran it on an average $2 million home in Sydney, right, and the average rental rate in most of those markets in Sydney.
It's crazy that that's an average these days.
100%. Yeah. Anyway. Man, the median house price, which takes obviously all the way out to Penrith and Campbelltown and all the rest of sort of stuff as well, like the obviously a little bit more blue collar markets out there, the average median house price in Sydney is like almost 1.2 mil now, you know, for including those sorts of markets.
Yeah.
So the really interesting thing, and the way that I like to look at it, is for the most part people can't really afford mortgage wise to live where they really want to live, so most of the time they're sacrificing, they're just buying to the max of what they can buy, but it's not their ultimate home. Now if it's not their ultimate home, my opinion, I wouldn't be going and buying that house. I'd be trying to invest that would allow me to get in there with profits of the additional amount instead of not even being able to buy it and buying something lackluster.
Yeah.
So running the numbers on a $2 million home, which in the same area, I was doing a bit of research, typically you're renting for about $1,000 or $1,200 a week. If you were to buy that $2 million home at an 80% LVR, so it's a 20% deposit, which most people like to do. For one, it's a $400,000 deposit.
A big deposit.
Plus closing. So you're probably in for about $450 odd sort of money once you take stamp duty and everything into equation as well. If you were to run that at 6.5% interest rate, it's around about $2,500 a week at the moment. Plus, if it was a unit, you got strata, you got council rates, you've obviously got your insurances and maintenance, all that sort of stuff that you have to pay as the actual owner of that property. You're looking at about $2,500 a week just on the mortgage. So the extra stuff, you're probably looking in the high twos, maybe you clip $3,000 a week over the course of this thing in exchange of renting, which might be $1,000 or $1,200 a week. So you're literally, you're more than double, if not two and a half, going close to three times when it comes to actually ownership of that property compared to what it would cost to rent it. I learned this very early in myself when I started running scenarios on the house that I was living in, because I moved out at 19 and I bought my first home and I never rented until I was 28. I was shown the serviceability difference, and that was the light bulb moment for me to start rent vesting instead of owning my own home.
Mm. I guess what we should say here as well, or firstly, you don't actually own a principal place of residence, do you?
I don't, not anymore.
Yeah, you've just...
practicing what you preach.
Practicing what you preach, 100%. Yes. Investing your way to... I can't wait to see what you finally buy. It's going to be epic. Yeah.
The crazy thing, it keeps leveling up, right? Like you keep changing what you want. And
yeah, yeah.
Especially as your portfolio gets bigger and you make more and more, it changes your mindset of what you actually can afford to own as well. Mm. So no longer is it like a one and a half mil in the burbs, it starts going up a bit, and then a bit more and a bit
constantly
more.
Constantly chasing.
100%.
I think what we should cover here as well is when you're thinking about this rent vesting approach, you're not saying I'm going to, you know, live in Double Bay and then rent vest in Wallara. You're actually then looking at, and what you help people do is actually find property with good yield and good return in that $500,000 to $700,000 bracket where you can actually afford to get into the property.
Yeah, and obviously your yields are so, they're quite decent at that sort of price point as well, which allows it to service itself to a decent level. Like exactly that example, if you were to rent there for $1,000 a week in say Double Bay, but then go and invest in Wallara, the ratio, the yields are probably almost the same. So you may as well just own in Double Bay, right? Mm. But if you were to go off, and it's also the wrong point in the cycle, in my opinion, to be buying there right now as well. So if instead you were to go off into a different capital city that might be lower in its cycle, so it hasn't had as much growth, say, in the last 10 years, 5-10 years. And then, obviously, the yields are stronger, lower point in the cycle, can negotiate a better price, and you've got more room for growth. You could build your wealth much more substantially down that avenue than trying to go and buy a blue-chip property that has got a terrible year, is going to bleed you anyway. So it's definitely a much better formula for success on that side.
Mm.
Yeah. So we have a friend who lives in Darwin, and he was saying that there's a property there that gets $400 a week rent and is selling for $200,000.
There you go.
So that's
10%
yield. That's a 10% rental yield.
Yeah.
So like that's, I guess, the comparison to someone, you know, listening in Brisbane, Sydney or Melbourne.
They're the extremes.
That probably is half the deposit of
the average house in Sydney. Yeah. So definitely, if people are conceptualizing like what this looks like, it's like, you know, renting wherever you're living and buying the $200,000 place with maybe a $20,000 or $40,000 deposit rather than a $400,000 deposit, and servicing a $160,000 mortgage rather than a $1.6 million mortgage.
Well, the rent services the mortgage as well, right? So the rent services the mortgage plus surplus. And I think that's a big thing that a lot of people miss in the equation, is it's not like, because I can go and buy $2 million worth of primary residence, that's all I can do from investing. The investing can go so much further because you have that rental income coming in as well. So that's the real sweetener in this whole scenario here as you build it out, is if you build the portfolio out correctly, your actual cost or your running cost of this thing should be next to zero. Initially, it might be a little bit as you build it out, and you know, as yields grow, and you might build some different deals in there as well from a cash flow perspective. But you can definitely build a portfolio that takes care of itself, and then the growth comes through, and obviously that's where you can make your serious profits on.
So for someone who's not interested in growing a 54 property portfolio, but has the, you know, is in a position to service a loan, but perhaps not in the area that they want right now.
Yep.
How does this strategy help people actually get to that point in buying a principal place of residence in their, you know, favorite suburb?
Yeah, man, this is the biggest thing I love about it, because when I look at what I could afford back in the day, I could afford like a maybe $700,000-$800,000 property at most. But you accumulate, let's say, $1-2 million worth of property, and it goes through a decent cycle, let's say in a 5-10, even just, in my opinion, underperforming in 10 years, that 2 million doubles to 4 million, and then that's your profit. Like from that end, all of a sudden I was only able to buy a $700,000 property. And yes, there's growth across the board, right? But now I've just banked $2 million plus whatever I put into it that I can come out. And yes, you pay a little bit of tax, but capital gains tax exemptions and whatnot are obviously within Australia. If you own a property for over 12 months, there's a lot of different things that we can, you know, profit, and you break them down, sell them in different years. So you profit, you can minimize your tax in a pretty effective way. All of a sudden my $700,000 or $800,000 primary residence I was going to be able to buy, now I can combine the two mills, you know, and actually take that in as profit, maybe in the three mills as profit. It's a completely different house, completely different area, you know, and ultimately it's probably what you really want. So I think there's like a lot of the time there's like multiple ways of looking at rent vesting, and some people want to do it purely to be able to get themselves into their primary residence. And so you might go out there and build a foundation of investments, and depending on your income level, maybe you go towards $2-3 million worth of growth properties, and that's all you go in for. Game plan of 5 to 7 years, be able to sell all these down. Hopefully that portfolio, or the aim is the portfolio, maybe to double or go close to doubling, sell them off, clear your debt, and then you have that massive chunk profit to then roll into a primary residence. And you might pair that up with $1 million worth of borrowing, and your 3 mil profit with $1 million worth of borrowing, and all of a sudden you're into a 4 mil primary residence. And obviously it takes time to go through, but that literally could be like $2 million is worth of exposure in the market is 4 properties at 500, or 3 mil is 5 properties at 600. It's a very sort of replicatable sort of thing. And you can do it in any sort of deposit amount as well. So if you have a smaller amount of deposit, just enter a lower price pointed market. A lot of the time your lower price pointed market will also have stronger yields. So if you've got a lower deposit, you might be a lower income earner. That retains your serviceability and allows you to kind of keep moving forward and getting into the next one as well. So it's always different. And some people will do it purely to build out a passive income. And then some people will do it as the hybrid. But I've got a lot of people that like, they realize the value in rent vesting, or you know, $2-4 million home and what that would actually rent for. Mm. You know, $4 million home might only rent for 1500, maybe $2,000 a week, right? They might be able to build out a portfolio that gives them 250,000 per annum net passive in the next 10, 15 years, right? And when they build that out, they might assign 100,000 of that 250 to go towards rent for the rest of time. And the coolest thing is obviously your CPI, like rent is very closely tied to inflation. So as values and as rents and everything else climbs, so do your rents, which continues to be able to pay for your mortgage, and plus the 150K passive income on the side as well. So we have a lot of people that kind of build them in different ways. They want to go purely for the primary residence. Some purely want to go for the lifestyle passive income play, and probably majority build for both. Mm. They build for primary residence, but at the end, I want to build the passive income first, build the portfolio that can carry through the next 10, 15 years. And then at the end, I'll buy that primary residence and I've got the passive income too. So but it's always relevant to everyone's goals. Everyone's different. So
yeah, it's something I wish I had known about when I like got my first post uni job. Mm. And it was like property seemed like such a far away goal, and thinking about needing enough for a deposit and all of that. And then also just feeling like every year I was falling further and further behind where I needed to be to buy that property.
Yeah.
Whereas if I had changed my mindset, well, if I'd known about this and had been like, what can I get now and let's just do it and service like a 150 grand mortgage, it would have just changed. I would have changed the way I invested. May not have invested in the stock market.
Probably
still. Well, could have done both, I guess, is kind of the point.
I mean, I think this is the thing, man. I look back on my journey and I don't really know or understand stocks that much because I didn't put the time into it. I found that magazine at 19 and that was my, like, I just gave myself a bachelor's in property, right? But if it had never worked, maybe I would have gone into maybe into share trading or something like that, stocks. But man, I think like the ability for someone like me, I was a low income earner. I didn't have much of a deposit. And I know you want to talk about recycling equity in a second, but like that's where that leverage point, because I was such a low income earner, that leverage point of being able to strip equity back out and go and buy another deal, that was the game changer for me in being able to continue to scale the portfolio. So,
well, let's move to equity recycling. And I'll put my hand up and say when we first started getting these questions through contact@equitymates.com, I hadn't heard the term before. Like I'm not a property guy. I've only recently bought, but you know, pretty green to all of this. So for people like me, what is it?
So you understand that obviously the concept of leverage and leveraging.
Yeah.
Right. So the beautiful part of this thing is it's just leveraging as much as you, not as much as you can, but leveraging and continue to leverage. Okay. So the easiest way to look at it is, let's say if you had 100,000 and you put that 100 grand out in the stock market, your return is directly involved with the amount that you put in. Yeah. Whereas in property, obviously it's based off a leveraged return. So my return isn't on 100,000. One part of it is, but my return actually comes off the, let's say I do a 20% deposit on a $400,000 property plus closings. That's 100 grand. But I don't get the growth on the 100 grand. I get the growth on the 400 grand property. Mm. Or if I leverage it and I go to a $500,000 property with a 10-12% deposit, pay a bit of mortgage insurance, then I stretch and my asset is now worth 500,000. I get the growth on the 500 grand asset, not on the 100,000. It is on the 100,000, but it's...
For people who are more attuned to the stock market, this is the difference between return on equity, which is the money you've put into the deal, and then return on assets, which is like what the asset is earning.
Yeah. So, I mean, you look at that scenario, if you could make 5% on the way into that deal, which we typically do every single deal or more for our clients... Man, like 5% on this plus a say 15% growth rate, you pick a market really well, which for the last like 4 or 5 years, we've averaged 20% plus every year, right? But if you just went the 15% return plus the 5% on the way in, that's 20%. On your $400,000 property, that's 80,000 in year one. On your 500 grand asset, that's 100 grand in that time frame, right? 100 grand on the 100,000 in, you're 100% cash on cash in that first year. Now, the idea of recycling equity is then being able to go back in and, okay, well, now we have our valuations, just use the 500 grand properties a bit cleaner. We've got that $500,000, it's gone up by 20%. We've got a bank of about 600,000. That'll allow you to pull out that difference. So essentially take a new equity release mortgage and take that loan up and release the difference between the new valuation and the old valuation. So essentially being able to increase the old loan to the new loan and pull out that new cash.
So if I can summarize it, you buy a house with a 20% deposit, so your LVR is 80%, and then the house grows in value, and so your LVR comes down, and it might be at 60%, then you basically take another mortgage out to push your LVR back out to the 80%.
Yeah, so you're kind of keeping it at that 80 or 88, however you want to run it, LVR, and that's when it really starts to compound, right? Because your initial $100,000 investment, now you're pulling out and actually putting in another deal and allowing, and then having multiple exposure in the market. And then again, you go another 6, 12 months, you're able to kind of essentially revalue them again, pull those loans back up to the, as I say, 80, 88% of that new valuation, pull that out, go into another deal.
So I am a property investor, or I'm an owner-occupier. I've got a mortgage. I've been paying it down. I guess my choice is I continue to pay off that mortgage and continue to make it smaller and smaller. Or I make the mortgage bigger, I guess, in some ways, and pull the equity out and buy another property. How do I think through that decision, and what are some of the factors that make me think one is right and one is wrong?
I think the biggest thing we'll take into account is your cash flows and your actual ability to take on that additional debt. If you've got the ability to take on the additional debt, for one, it's tax deductible because you're going to use it for investment purposes. So if you pull out $100,000, current interest rates are, let's say, 6.5%, $6,500 a year to take that out.
And the thing to stress there is your repayments on a mortgage for your primary place of residence, not tax deductible, but as an investor, they are tax deductible.
Just be that, say, $100,000 in this example that you'd pull out, that's fully tax deductible, right? Because you purely use it for the investment purposes. But let's say you go out there and put it in the marketplace and get that return, or even if you fell a little bit short and you, instead of the 80 or 100,000, you hit 65,000. It's a 10x return on the $6,500 worth of additional repayment you obviously have to pay for pulling that money out as well. But I think the really cool thing as well is like, not only is it a 10x return on the $6,500 in interest every year, but you can write that off and everything associated with that property as well. You can write it all off. So it's not even 6.5. It might come out at 4 after tax or something like that. So that's a massive return. And the beautiful part of it is then being able to compound that and leverage back out of it and continue this recycling equity way of building a portfolio. And leverage really is, it's a property investor's best friend and it's his biggest asset. If you don't utilize leverage properly, like I remember it was always people, they'd go buy a property and they'd be so proud because they then focus on paying it off. And I'm not talking about a primary residence. That obviously is a massive achievement. I'm talking about an investment. But when you're in investment, you want to accumulate as much as you can before you worry about consolidation and debt reduction, because the amount of money you have in the marketplace is a direct correlation to how much you're going to make back as well. So if you're focusing on paying it down, it takes you 10 years to pay it down, well done. But someone else who maybe didn't even perform as well with their first singular asset, they could have had half the growth as you had, but they're going to be in a better off position because of that leverage return, that leverage growth on initial capital.
So how often are you getting your properties valued?
I value mine every 6 months.
Every 6 months?
Yeah. So I got to, obviously my portfolio is a little bit different, right? So it's quite large. So when I go through it, it also takes ages to get everything done for it. So when I do it, I reval everything. I don't always strip all the equity out of it. A lot of the time I actually won't. But I'll reval everything, see what might have a fair bit of surplus. I'm at the point now where I build, say, secondary dwellings, and I build things like that in cash. I do big renovations in cash. And if like a little cheapie comes up that needs a big renovation, and maybe it's not the right deal to give to a client, I might buy that in cash and then renovate it. And then when it comes around to every 6 months, I'll reval all that stuff and pull that cash back out. So it's like that is continual working capital for me. But for most of our clients, they'll still reval every 6 months because if there's equity there that they can release and then get into another deal, you know, if we're buying in the correct markets, you're just massively going to outperform that on that front. And rents have been growing really strongly. So even though you're taking on more debt by pulling it out, because the rental growth has been so strong, it's more than covering the additional repayments anyway of pulling that extra equity out.
And this is the, you don't have to put it into property. You can put it into stocks as well.
Yeah, it's investment purposes. Investment, right? For sure.
Yeah.
And that's
Excited. So you just need to do the math to make sure it works.
Yeah, and it's all diversity, right?
It's any investment.
Yeah, so it's all what you want to do. And if you really know stock market and you really want to go ham in that, but maybe build out a $1.5 million asset base in property, you literally could put the 100 in and then recycle it out in 12 months, put that 100 that you might make back into another one, and then again, and then it may be in a 2-year window, you might have the ability to actually pull the initial 100,000 back out and either put it back in the primary residence and pay that 100 grand off or put it into the share market, however you want to roll, however you want to do with it. But then you've got that $1.5 million asset base that's going to keep growing for you and you've leveraged it. And what I love about this is if you pulled that initial 100 grand back out and did pay the primary residence off, where's your exposure? Like you actually don't have any money in the deals. You've pulled it out and you've paid that initial loan back off. So it's literally like an infinite return on whatever you can make on that front as well. That's what I love in that sense is I look at how the size of the portfolio I built making an ordinary, for the first 10 years of my portfolio, first 10 years, but my first 15 years of my working life, I was making an average Australian income or substantially less, especially when I started. I look at the size of the portfolio that I built in that time frame. It all came from leverage and understanding how to work it. And then when I was a bit tight on serviceability, putting the right cash flow deals in. So it's all being strategic with it, but it all comes down to that leverage piece and being able to keep pulling it from that front and then building it correctly.
We've had an advisor on the show who spoke about with their clients, they will pull it out, put it in stock that is like high yield and then use the income from that to keep paying down the principal residence and then just keep recycling that to almost speed up the repayment on only principal residence.
Yeah. So, it's pretty much just, without going out too front of limit, it's pretty much that, but on steroids because you got leverage.
Yeah. Right?
And leverage is the game changer.
Yeah. Now, you said it was all about, you've grown this portfolio all by the equity recycling and the structure of the deal. It has also helped that the Australian property market has ripped for the last 15 years. If we assume, when you're thinking about this, I assume you should also stress test different levels of growth and stuff like that. So you mentioned one part of it was considering this is right for you, what's your cash flow like? Can you service the debt? And that's table stakes.
Huge.
How do you think about the overall property market and the risk of, it falling or just being flat for a while? How do you think about the different scenarios and how that would change rent vesting as a strategy?
Yeah, I always look at that very closely, man. It's something I take massively into because obviously when we're investing for clients, we're constantly picking the correct areas to go and put clients in for continued growth. Something I've always seen, and there's multiple charts of this out there as well, but if you look at the last 50 years in property, when somewhere's bottoming out or going through a trough, like most areas will trough for normally 10 years, then they go through rapid growth in typically a 3 to 4 year window, and then they might peak out and trough off for another 10 years. It's funny when you say that it's been on a ripping run for the last 15 years, right? But if you look at 2003 to 2013, Sydney did nothing. And then from 2013 to now, it has been on a great run, but it finished in 2017. COVID kicked it back into gear to have another run, but it finished after that 4 year run and it had been flat for 10 years. If you look at a lot of markets like Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth, they did nothing for 10 to 12 years, some of them 14 years before they started again, either at the start of Adelaide started just before COVID, Brisbane started with COVID, Southeast Queensland got smashed off the back of COVID, Perth started kind of more when COVID was wrapping up. So they all move in different cycles. And so it's understanding where they are in cycles. And cycles is a funny term because it kind of sounds like, oh, well, it's clockwork, right? It's going to happen all the time. It's definitely not clockwork. But what happens is when a market troughs for 10 to 15 years, it becomes affordable again because everything keeps increasing in value, but a lot of time the property prices will actually come off over that time frame. You look at Sydney from 2003 to 2013, value, you could actually buy a house cheaper in 2012, 2013 than you could in 2003. Values were lower. And so you look at that, but everyone's making, you know, money does increase and wages increase in Sydney and all the rest of it. So it all comes down to like a relative affordability part with this stuff as well. So it's been on a ripping run for the last, you know, however many years. Sydney and Melbourne and stuff came off 21, 22, hadn't done too much sort of since then as well. So it's like, there's always moving in different points, you know what I mean? But you look at other markets, and there's other markets in Australia the last 2 years have done 30% a year for the last 2-3 years as well, some of the smaller capital. So it's all about understanding where there actually is value in the market. And that's one of the big things, man. Like a lot of people these days say, oh, Sydney's king because Sydney had an amazing 10 years. I wouldn't be putting my money in Sydney because it had an amazing 10 years. It's due, probably not so much a correction, but it's due a lull period, you know, and a bit of a plateau. And we're seeing a little bit, the caveat on all of this at the moment is stock being so tight. Mm. And until stock really loosens up and building starts becoming massive and migration eases, that's what's keeping such a floor under the market and pushing it so hard as well.
Well, let's put a pin in that because we want to talk about the market generally. Yes. And I imagine the availability of stock and population growth is going to be central to that conversation.
Just give me a raise, man. Just give me a raise. I'm too early. I'm too young for it.
Let's turn to it. And I guess let's start generally. What the hell's going on with property in 2024?
Man, it's still a crazy time. It's a funny thing, man. I just to give a bit of context around this, right? I just went to get a couple of grannies built, so secondary dwellings built on a couple of properties I have down south of Sydney. The company that I had quoting up on these things that I'd built with like many, many years ago, we hadn't heard from them in a couple of weeks. This is literally this morning. My assistant sent me a photo, and on their website, they had to go into liquidation. Oh, they went into administration. One of the biggest builders on the Gold Coast that is known for their elite luxury builds went under like a month or two ago, went under at the start of this year in 2024. We are not building anywhere near enough homes, and so many builders are going under because we've got fixed price build contracts that I signed 6-12 months ago, and the price of materials is still increasing. The price of labor is still increasing. They can't complete these jobs and actually make a profit, and a lot of time they're losing on them. So in a nutshell, we're not building enough homes and we're not going to build enough homes. It's going to take a fair few years to get this back under control. You've also got migration on a crazy level. All the stuff that we spoke about last time, we've got a massive supply deficit still, even in available, like existing product as well. Even though it's picked up a little bit, especially in Sydney and Melbourne, stock has picked up, but it's not enough to, it's enough to like sate the appetite of the people that are there trying to buy. It's not enough to really cause a dip and a big dip in the market. So what we're seeing is they're your two biggest cities that if anything should dip, they should dip, and they're not really dipping. Mm. They're plateauing, right? They're both hovering around zero, one under, one over every quarter for the last little bit. When you look at a lot of the other capitals and a lot of the other regions, all those markets are on fire at the moment. They're still doing really well. Affordability, in my opinion, is a huge key in this. They still have room to growth, and stock and supply is so tight, and the affordability is still there, so it's still growing. So if Sydney still had that affordability, it would still be growing, but it's at a cap, right?
Yeah.
And so I think this is going to go through and play out for the next 12 months. I think 2024 is actually a great year to position yourself in the market. You're buying the right markets, you're still going to make good money, but I think going into 25 and 26, when interest rates start to properly come back down, inflation's almost back in the target band, I don't think they'll cut them straight away. It'll take a little bit of time for that to settle and wash through and whatnot. But I think once that is properly back under control, they'll start cutting rates again because obviously they're quite high at the moment, and start bringing them back into more long-term averages is probably around about that 5%, which means we're probably looking at around about a 1.5% cut. Once all that happens, you've still got the huge stock and supply deficits. You've still got massive migration. We're not building enough homes. And then you throw
interest rate cuts
on top. Like there's only one way the market's moving, especially if you're buying in the right markets, especially those affordable markets, because they've still got the biggest thing about the affordable markets, they've still got the room to grow. Debt to income ratios and average house price to income ratios will always cap a market. Mm. Yeah, and that's what's putting the cap on Sydney. Yeah. And those bigger cities that are more expensive. So yeah, man, there's still so much opportunity. I think the real opportunity is this year. And I think there's a lot of money to be made in 25, 26, but I think this is the year. If you set it up, people still be sitting on the sidelines. We've still got people saying, oh, we're going to wait till interest rates get cut. And like, that's when the masses are going to be coming back in. Mm. So I think this year, there'll be a lot of locations that still produce 20% plus growth this year. I think next year will be crazy. Yeah. In Australia. I reserve those ones for Australian property scout clients.
Fair call.
But it's it's a crazy thing to see. We called. I did a podcast. We got our own potty, right? Not this size, obviously, not Equity Mate size. We got our own potty, and we called late last year that I strongly believe a super boom's coming to the Australian housing market. And it's funny because I started talking about it, and for the whole episode, I was like, "It's not going to happen. Like, it's not going to go that big." And then we're laying all the things on the table, and then I looked at like the data of Sydney. And all the properties that I owned in Sydney that I bought around 2013, 2014 or before, they all doubled twice in a 10-year window. And I'm like, well, realistically, that was a super boom. It had 200% growth in that time frame. So it's not like it's not achievable. It all comes down to what the bank lending will let it go to and where the affordability of that market was. Now, I bought really low in the market cycle and also bought very cheap. So I achieved higher than average returns. But even the average person that paid market value in those markets still would have probably done 150% growth in a 10-year window. And I look at a lot of the markets now that maybe have even done 50, 60, 70% growth in the last 3 years. And a lot of those markets sitting at the same affordability thresholds that Sydney was like halfway through or less. So they've still got so much growth in the tank. And the only thing that stops this boom, in my opinion, is affordability cap. Because when interest rates come back, it'll keep going. It'll obviously increase the affordability cap on one side as well, but it will keep going. But the pressure is going to remain there for the next few years. We need the migration. We need the workers. We're not building enough homes. And supply, there's no end in sight for supply to come on more quickly. Because even if we could build enough homes, subdivisions and unit developments and townhouse developments, they take time. They need to get approved. They need to get through planning, get through approval. They need to get the funding and then they need to build it. By the time someone acquires a site, it's only 2 to 3 years before they start. And that might be for a subdivision. Then people have got to build homes on them. Mm. We're talking like a minimum 2, if not 3, 4 year turnaround before we can actually bring a lot of product to market. But heaps of builders going under. So like it's, you know what I mean? Like there's no actual clear end in sight for this thing. I think the clear end in sight will be affordability caps. That is where it will cap out and markets will max out. And I strongly believe that's where those caps will come in off the back of that. Because nothing else is showing promise for slowing the market down, right? Mm.
Yeah, I've been sitting here trying to think like what else could it be? And you think like, all right, well, is it government policy? But there's like, it's a supply demand challenge at the end of the day. And like, you know, even if they start changing like tax treatment of invested properties or, you know, whatever it is, it like doesn't change that fundamental supply and mismatch.
We always speak, we've said it multiple times, but any government policy is designed to increase demand.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fastest way to lose an election would be to cut, to have a policy that cuts so like, house prices 20%.
Yeah. 100%.
The way we'll be able to treat superannuation will probably change over time. Like there's all these things that they'll pull that
will only give us more. We've reached affordability limits. Yeah. Now you can use your super to pay it.
Yeah, exactly. And then we'll boost it again. Yeah, man.
We do not support that here. Sam might.
But the other massive thing of it is it's a correlation to rents as well, because rents are all in the same boat as this thing too. So I think this is one of those things, especially if you were to take on the earlier strategy before rent vesting as well. If you are going to rent vest, like invest. Don't sit on the sidelines. You know, if you are going to rent vest, try and make that money in it, make your growth and build your wealth in a different market that you can afford to be in and build the wealth there. And then once that market might have peaked out, sell it down, bring it back, buy that primary residence. If that is the game plan, that's the strategy and what you want to do, I wouldn't be sitting on the sidelines because I think there's a lot of price growth, a lot of rental growth still to come through in the next couple of years.
We keep calling it rent vesting, but I imagine there's a lot of people that started with a primary resident, equity recycle, pull some equity out and then buy in other markets, buy the $200,000 place in Darwin, which is seriously what I'm considering.
Yeah. Man, 100%. So there's you can do it from any avenue. And I think Bryce and I were talking about this off air and we were saying about the fact of it doesn't just need to be the rent vesting. So exactly what you're saying there. Like it definitely does not need to just be the rent vesting. Yeah. If you already own a primary residence, and that's where it's not, actually it's because we were talking about the pillars. Remember the different pillars in the way I build a portfolio, and rent vesting isn't a key pillar, because if you already own a primary residence, especially if you've got the debt low on it, you don't need a rent vest. You don't need to sell that or rent it or whatever and go and do it. So you can still live in a primary residence. If you bought it in Sydney 10 years ago, you're probably in an amazing position because your values have probably doubled. You've probably got a huge amount of equity there. Your loan's probably quite low. You're probably in literally the most primo position to start a portfolio.
Yeah.
And equity release, 100, 200 grand or whatever, it's all tax deductible. Keep it as a separate loan from your primary residence and then use that as working capital to start building a portfolio.
Yeah.
So it's, it doesn't have to be the rent vesting, but I think the rent vesting is a really strong strategy for anyone that's in the mortgage belt, whether they're owning or not, the mortgage belt of say a capital city, just because that ratio is very close.
What's the mortgage belt?
Yeah. So mortgage belt would be your average Australian. So in a capital city, a mortgage belt is where, that's where I was talking about before, of someone who might be a $700,000-$800,000 property that might rent for $600-$700, right? So it's a very close, it's where majority of people can afford. So where most average Australians, it's the mortgage belt of where the average Australians can afford to live.
Okay.
And that's where I kind of learned about this years ago, sort of from that end. So it's, it's one of those things you want to sort of push the avenue as hard as you can with this thing. If you're going to sit and buy in that sort of avenue, yeah, you want to try and build that portfolio on the side.
Mm. Yeah, you say it's about you wanting to push as hard as you can, but for me it's also a great strategy for people that don't want to push as hard as they can and don't want to be, you know, leveraged up to their eyeballs and feeling this mortgage stress trying to pay a mortgage. It's like, this is how you can push it, not too hard, but still push it.
Yeah. When you're leveraged and you've got the rental income coming in, if you've got those really good balance of the rent and obviously the loans, it's it is easy enough to hold, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but I think that's where it comes down to, exactly what you say, being careful with the managing your cash flows, forecasting what can you actually afford as surplus.
Mm.
And if I was maybe in the first 12 months until we get some good rental growth and rates start coming back, can I afford $5,000 a year negative on a property or $10,000 a year negative on a portfolio? And if you can afford that and you can get into the marketplace and in 12 months or 18 months, rates come back 1% and rents have gone up 10, 20% as well on your portfolio, then you're in a perfect position to continue to build. Or like you're saying, sit there, let the thing do its thing if you don't want to take on too much.
Yeah.
Obviously, I come from a different York.
I gotta
check myself, right?
No. You see, it's horses for courses, you know. Yeah. I'm just gonna lay out a different course.
That's cool, man. That's cool. And man, that's the thing. Everyone's different, right? So yeah, different people will want to go at a different pace and a different level. And exactly what you say, man, it's horses for courses. Some people want to go hard and some people, dip the toe in, maybe pull a trigger on a deal every 12, 24 months, whatever it is, but it'll help you move in the right direction as long as you're buying in the right location. That's that's the biggest thing.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Sam doesn't tell us the locations on this podcast. So if you do want to find the locations, you can hit Sam up at Australian Property Scout. Tell him Equity Mates sent you so he comes back on at some point.
That's it.
Or send us an email and we can connect you directly as well. Contact at equitymates.com. Well, Sam, you have always always leave us a lot to think about.
You always get us very excited about the possibility of investing.
Man, I love that I can excite you boys, because I know you do a lot of different things yourself. So it's, it's cool that if you boys take a lot away from it, then I hope the audience does as well. And keep spreading the love about the old property investing. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, that's australianpropertyscout.com.au. And Sam, it's been a pleasure as always.
Likewise, boys. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
You have been listening to an Equity Mates Media production. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This podcast is intended for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general advice only and has not taken into account your personal financial circumstances, needs, or objectives. Before acting on general advice, you should consider if it is relevant to your needs and read the relevant product disclosure statement. And if you're unsure, please speak to a financial professional. The hosts of this podcast and their guests may have positions in the companies mentioned. Equity Mates Media operates under an Australian Financial Services License 540697.